Hi, I'm Bob. I'm an alcoholic. Through the grace of God and Alcoholics Anonymous and sponsorship of Heaven on Drinks of the 10th of December, 1967, and for that I'm very grateful. This has been an extraordinary weekend. A lot of those guys who get to a lot of conferences have been talking that this is just not an ordinary event. Maybe some of you who don't get around, there just isn't this feeling every place you go. There isn't this vitality. There isn't this energy. We've heard some great talks this weekend. You can't give a talk if there isn't what's present here this weekend present. There's pitchers and catchers. We create, you know, it gets created by who's here and what the listening is. And there's something in this room that isn't in all rooms. When they read that list of conferences, Cook's Forest and Blackstone and Brownwood and Cedar Glen and Canyon and Mountain High and here, I've been to all of them except Cedar Glen. I've been invited two or three times, but I couldn't get to it. I knew Bob White and Tom Levern and many of the men that were active early on in those conferences. Bob White would have loved this conference. He would have loved John and Cindy. I have a home in Texas, and the reason I have the home in Texas is Bob and Marceline White. 1975, I was giving a talk in Hot Springs, Arkansas. I walked into a room and fell in love with Bob and Marceline. And many times in Alcoholics Anonymous, one or two people just change your life or add to it in such a significant way that it was kind of hard to imagine, whether it's your sponsor or a couple of friends, couples that start hanging out in the program and sharing their lives. It's just, there's something very special. What happens at a conference like this, and Jesse, thank you for all your work, it just keeps giving. You know, when you create something like this, it just keeps giving. And it's, you know, I was up at Alaska at your guys' Denali conference, and that's going to be an event, is, and as it gets a little bit larger, I think there's size has something to do with it, too. Intimacy has, it isn't all size. There are some large conferences that have a little of this. There are some smaller ones that have it, but this is close to perfect. And but I think the care in which you people address Alcoholics Anonymous, the care in which you hold it, the respect, is the basis and the foundation for this. And people joke around once in a while about, you know, you guys are the leaders of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm glad I'm not going to be here, you know, to see it. I think the people, I mean, you hear those jokes about the new people coming up. I think the people who were my heroes, who are mostly gone, if they walked in this room and saw it, they wouldn't know it was 2005. This could be 1975. This could be 1965. What's here is really solid, really great AA. So thank you. Thanks for the invitation. My hosting, I when I was up in Alaska, I had the worst host I've ever had in Alcoholics Anonymous. His name was Andrew, and by him. And we've got a close second going this weekend, Andrew. With him. I think there are new traditions we often bring in. I think urine testing of hosts is something that I'm gonna suggest to the committee just as a consideration. I mean, we're doing it now with baseball players and all, you know, bicyclists, and I think urine testing hosts would be good. No, thank you, John. That's been a good run. I apologize for not having making a decision to leave early, but I've been traveling a lot, and I'm gonna go home and have dinner with our grandchild and take off in an airplane again Tuesday. So that's what's going on. The talks this weekend were great. Sterling I hadn't heard for a while, and that was good. And Tim I had not heard, and I really very much enjoyed your talk. My wife doesn't talk much, doesn't like to talk. I love to hear you share. I've been a great source of growth for Linda. I don't think she'd have half the program she has if it wasn't for me. I don't get enough credit, I don't think, for my participation in that. But it is, because she doesn't talk much, maybe like once a year, when I hear it, they're just different, you know, you live it together and you share it together. And it's really, it's been a hell of a run. You know, 38 years, I can remember in the bedroom praying for Daniel and Peter and Peter, you know, that little crap head that we had up here at the retreat, our middle boy. And he was at St. Edward's. He went to 5 colleges. And I don't know how long he was sober, 12 or 13 years ago, maybe 2 years. And so you guys were just great to him, really nice, and I think helped nudge him. Today he's a fine member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That little guy in 2 months is going to graduate from the University of Oxford with an MBA. And this week he's in India with the Dalai Lama and Dharamsala. You couldn't draw a straight line. I thought if he was ever going to be at Oxford, it would have been the prison in Mississippi, not not the university. And when I go to a sober house on Tuesdays and we do a little book study, and I wish you could paint the picture for the new men and women, you know, the people who are 23 that don't get the bigger picture, that they're looking at the next 5 minutes or the next 5 days or the next 5 weeks. And if you could say, if you build the boat right, if you build the foundation right, you can go anywhere you want to go. There aren't, you know, are there limits? Sure, you're not going to be the king of England. But there aren't much in the way of limits. And most of the limits we've constructed. They're, you know, when we get in this program and we start cooperating with the universe, it's just extraordinary the things that come out of it. Bob, you gave a wonderful talk. I don't know if it'd be sacrilegious to say, I think what you did last night was even a step up on what your sponsor does. The description of the alcoholic mind, the emotions, the thinking, the feeling, and the sort of thing. You brought a, you know, you go to an extraordinary amount of meetings and you hear an extraordinary amount of speakers, and the synthesis and the use of, it was a painting that was, you know, really good. John and Cindy, thank you for having us here. I started drinking when I was 13. I'm one of 7 kids, grew up in a wonderful family. My heroes were my father and his friends. Those were the Second World War guys that came back and they drank hard, worked hard, and played hard. They built businesses, they were active in their communities. They made life look easy, and they had cocktail parties. Everything they did, you know, at least my parents and most of their friends, booze was connected with it. And those were our models. We, you know, so when we started drinking, we were playing house. You know, we started stealing booze out of, they had bartenders, and we started stealing booze out of the parties when we were, you know, 12 and 13 years old, and we went out. And same story. When I entered high school, I was 4'11", weighed 95 pounds. I was the second smallest kid in my class. You just feel insecure. Most of it was mouth. You know, you just, you know, and you feel like everybody else knows more than you do. You feel like they got to school an hour early, hold a meeting, decide what to do for the day, and you never get to attend the meeting. You know, it seems like everybody else has got a play card and you don't. When we take that drink of alcohol, all of a sudden it's like, bam. We start feeling on the inside like they look on the outside. And Bob, you know, just talked about that. That's the trouble with talking about Sunday. You get everybody else's talk in your head. And it's but it is. You just, what alcohol did for me that day, I don't know why you wouldn't go back to it. I went back to it as often and as hard as I could, and by the time I was in my junior and sophomore year in high school, I had a reputation for drinking, and I was in trouble. I was making those false ID cards on paper. You know, I had a set of colored pencils, and I could forge the seal, you know, and everything. And I mean, I didn't reach puberty until I was 30. I don't know how the hell I got served, you know, but it was just kind of a kind of an access in. I went to a military high school and a college campus. We drank. We had fraternities. We drank in high school like most people drink in college. I was in a lot of trouble. I got a chance to go away to school. Thought getting away from the parents and the cops was a good idea. I went away to school. My drinking did not change. I went to drank my way out of the University of Notre Dame, middle of my senior year. You know, I was in civil engineering, but I was going to school about one day out of 10, and it gets kind of tough to bluff your way through a thermodynamics exam. And even for an alcoholic. And, you know, Rudy, he got to go to Notre Dame. I passed through. You know, I mean, I didn't get the experience. You know, I mean, that's the trouble. If you're an alcoholic, you don't get to have a life. You know, you get pieces, but you don't get to have a life. Never get to use your gifts. Most of us have something to do, some people to touch, some places to go, and that are unique to us. You know, that no one else can do in exactly the way we're meant to do it. And if you're drunk, you don't ever get to do them. You don't ever get the present out of the box. The box is still under the piano with the bow on it. You know, we never even get to know where to look. And when I was going to walk out of Notre Dame, I had to get a medical release. I was in ROTC. I was due to be commissioned, and the medical release I got was for alcoholism. I was diagnosed alcoholic when I was 19. That seemed goofy to me. It didn't seem 19 years old alcoholic. It didn't seem possible. But I ran into a psychiatrist who knew quite a bit about alcoholism, and I kept trying to tell him I drank like my friends, and he said, well, maybe. But he said, you just keep picking different friends, and you do it more often. You do it 3-4 days a week. You're in trouble. You're the one getting, you know, it isn't bad luck. You got a pattern. And I remember when I went down to Notre Dame, when I got diagnosed, I went to the library and got a book on alcoholism, and it was a Freudian book, and it related alcoholism to latent homosexuality. And the combination of those two things made me reluctant to throw myself wholeheartedly into the process. And I went to a psychiatrist, and the very first question she asked me was I gay? And I was not ready for all those conversations for a number of reasons. I don't and so I got a diagnosis of alcoholism. I got out of the Army. I came home. I finished school at a local university. And when I finished school, my father asked me to leave the house. And he said, Bob, we love you, but we've just had about all of you we can stand. You know, there's 6 other kids in the family. This isn't working. Good luck. And, you know, that sounds quick and short, but we loved each other. You know, for my dad to get to a point to say, you know, and I was the oldest son and going away to school and all those sorts of things, that was just a series of failures. It was just, you know, just the high cost of low living. I mean, it was just tacky. You know, alcoholism, you know, I'm going to tell you kind of a few funny things I did. But mostly it's just tacky. Mostly it's just treating people poorly, spending money you don't have, getting in trouble, being places you shouldn't be. And so when I finished school and left the house, I got a job at a liquor store. I'm drinking this is the last year of my drinking. I'm drinking a fifth a day. I got fired from that job. I used to steal liquor. I'd stock. I'd throw cardboard boxes out the back, and every third box I threw a fifth in, and, you know, I'd come around at midnight and pick the fifths out of the empty boxes. And then I got fired from that job, and I got a job as a waiter. And Linda and I were going together. We broke up. Linda kind of abbreviates. I don't know whether it's been so long since. I got fixed up with Linda. We were going out. Things were pretty good. My alcoholism was progressing, and for about a year, we didn't see each other. And I'd call her like a low-grade headache. I'd call her about once a month, just about the time she started dating someone else. I'd call her up just to kind of irritate her, you know, just you know, just so she couldn't be entirely free of me. So, and and I was a mess that last 6 months. So I'm working as a waiter at the Minneapolis Athletic Club. I'm living on, not Skid Row, but close. I'm living in $5 night rooms. I'm shacking up with waiters and waitresses. You know, Dr. Sooth, the child author, those are actual photographs of people I live with during the last year of my drinking. And I'm getting up in the morning, drinking a couple of Dexedrine, drinking a couple of beers. I go to work from 10 to 2. I work as a waiter. At 2 o'clock, I go drink beer at a bar from 2 to 5. And at 5, I go buy a pint. And then I'd figure out where I was going to live or stay for that night or that week. And I went to a party one night, got my face kicked in. I got fired as a waiter. I had no place to go. And I went back to the family and asked them if I could move back in the house. They hadn't seen me for 4 or 5 months. And they allowed me back in the house on the condition that I wouldn't drink, and I went back and I didn't drink, or I lied. I once started to go through withdrawal. I'm 23 years old. I have an enlarged liver. I never thought you'd get in trouble not drinking, you know, so I started to hallucinate the first night I got back in the house. So I snuck downstairs and drank my way out of it and got back together with Linda shortly thereafter. I don't know why she wanted a mess like me. I showed up at a party and I had my face kicked in and said I'd like to talk to her. And Linda, there was always something about Linda that I was attracted to, and I said, I don't know what's going on, but I said, I'd like to give me one more chance. You know, give me a shot at, you know, all I want to do is look at marriage. You know, not interested in dating. We'll take a look at it. And we kind of dated platonically for about, you know, we had a hot and heavy relationship before, and we kind of cooled it off and took a look at it, and within a few months we were engaged, and it's been an interesting ride. My ride's a little different than most of yours. I had problems in sobriety, and I know that most of you don't. And so that's, you know, how speakers all have, you know, little areas that they specialize in. I'm the loser in sobriety. So that's, you know, so it's a... And so I continued to drink. I got a job. Vietnam was kind of on my mind in those days. I was getting ready to go. I got accepted to Officer Candidate School, and when I went in, they lost my physical, and I had to take the physical again. They failed me. Fourth or fifth time, I took the physical. Got a job at a local firm, and now I'm the company drunk. I mean, at Notre Dame, I was the class drunk. I had three guys petition to have me removed from engineering school. They used my room as a study hall because I was never in it. Now I'm in this company of engineers. I'm falling asleep at my desk. I just cannot stop drinking. I don't, you know, I mean, I'm a bar drinker, and most of the time during the day I didn't drink when I was at work, but I couldn't shut it down. And I'd go out, you know, I'd leave work early and I'd go on out, and I'd just, you know, 2 o'clock in the morning, shaking my head, pounding the bar. And then, you know, I had this photographer at the company just let me sleep my hangovers off in the dark room. And I'm in trouble, and I know I'm in trouble, and I quit this job. I remember when I went back to make amends to my boss, he said, I couldn't figure you out. He said, you interviewed so well, you know. Don't we interview well? They should give prizes for interviewing. And I quit that job. I took a sales job, thought I'd have a little bit, you know, more luck selling, and people not keeping track of me, and I'm about 3 months into that sales job, and a buddy of mine gets married, and I go out in about a four-day drunk, and I wake up Thursday afternoon sometime in July of 1967, and I haven't been to work in 3 days. I, you know, came out of about an not eight-hour blackout, but, you know, much of the night was I almost got into a fight with a guy I should not have gotten into a fight with at the wedding or bachelor party. And I'm scared. I don't know if a job, a fiance, or a place to live until I'm married. And all of a sudden, the recommendation of my psychiatrist and my father that I look into Alcoholics Anonymous didn't seem like such an impossible idea, and I called AA. And I got an old-timer down to central office, and he talked to me for, I don't know, about a half hour on the phone, and then he called another guy and asked me if I could go meet a couple of guys at a cafe at about 5:30. And I said, yeah, I couldn't. After I hung up, I found out I still had a job, and Linda was still talking to me. We were getting the rings back in those days. of my five closest buddies in high school, three of whom were my closest buddies in grade school. Four of us are members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and one's an Al-Anon. So, and he was my roommate for 2 years at Notre Dame. We were kind of the odd couple, and so there was a lot of alcoholism. In my class of 115 guys, I think we have a dozen guys in Alcoholics Anonymous. We had a lot of alcoholism, but we had a lot of recovery. Pretty unusual for a small, you know, for a small school. And where was I? Who knows? Oh, so we're all getting the rings back. You know, we're all drunk. You know, thank you. Yeah, they're that a girl. And so I'm trying to get my life together. You know, no one hated my life more than I hated my life. I mean, I can't tell you, you know, the once or twice a year where the police would bring you home or you get arrested, and my mother and father would be, you know, I've cried myself to sleep listening to my parents argue about what to do with me. I love my family. My mom and dad are now dead, and we're having meetings with the estate. 3 or 4 years later, we're still trying to figure out what to do with the lake cabin. There's 7 kids, and it's just been, and the good news, no arguments. You know, I mean, but it's complex, and we're going through this thing, and I think maybe at the last meeting we may have found a solution after, I think, 9 or 10 meetings. But we'd be in the living room, and my sisters would be crying, my brothers would want to be kicking the crap out of me, and my parents were just at their wits' end. They're just absolutely at their wits' end, didn't know what to do. Little did I know that we'd be playing the other half of that, you know, later in life. And it's, you know, didn't like being the family problem. Moved back in the house, got a job, got engaged, thought my life was going to get back together, couldn't shut my drinking down. So I called Alcoholics Anonymous. These two guys come out and talk to me. And in an hour, they changed my life. The most unexpected thing that ever happened. Two guys, I have been to every kind of help that you could get, doctors, lawyers, Indian chiefs, priests, bishops, nuns, you know, psychiatrists. I sit down with two, the first time I've ever sat down with two guys that had a drinking problem. They sat down, told me their story, told me about Alcoholics Anonymous, and they changed my life. That night, I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. An extraordinary experience for me. The gift I've been given, I liked AA from the moment I walked in. I don't know why I was given that gift. I worked with, in those early days, I worked with a lot of young people. We started, it was in the late 60s and early 70s, we had a lot of treatment. Had a lot of young people. And they said, oh, there's a young guy over at Uptown. And they, you know, hooked me up, and I got hooked up a lot. I took a lot of young, you know, and most of them didn't stick. And I could never figure out. As long as I was taking the meetings, they'd hang out. But, as, you know, when I stopped taking them, they wouldn't stick. And for whatever reason, they didn't identify. Most of them needed it more than I did and had more in trouble than I would. But the gift I had is that I liked AA since the time I came in. I was told by my sponsor that alcoholism is a disease. It's threefold: physical, mental, and spiritual. Once you cross the line from problem drinking into alcoholism, your alcoholism affects you all the time, when you're drinking and when you're not drinking. Now, the idea that alcoholism could affect you when you were not drinking was like rocket science to me. I thought what I had, you know, if I stopped drinking, my life would clear up. That was a clear message that I got, you know, since I've been about 15 years old. I tried getting sober. Just before I went back to my senior year at Notre Dame, I was beaten, robbed, rolled, pistol whipped, shot at, thrown out of the second story of a hotel, ended up in a psych ward in a hospital. I went back to school. I didn't drink for 3 months. My life did not clear up. Sobriety or abstinence was not my answer. They said, you know, I remember my, you know, sponsor looked at me and he said, have you ever quit? And I said, yeah. He said, did it work? I said, no. He said, I didn't think so. What's wrong with us? It's alcoholism. Looks and sounds like alcohol, but it isn't. It's different. This is threefold: physical, mental, and spiritual. What we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, once we take our last drink of alcohol, we use the 12 steps to change our lives. If you don't change, you're going to go back to drinking and using because you don't know how to live sober. That was like the Gettysburg Address. I can still remember the chair I was sitting in when Warren, my sponsor, I have the same sponsor I got when I walked in the front door. He's 51 years sober. He's 86 years old. He still goes to the meetings. He's still active. He was perfect for me. Absolutely perfect. So I got sober. I started, you know, very, very active, going to 6 or 7 meetings a week. Linda and I are starting to have trouble because I'm so active in AA. We're seeing less of each other married than we were dating. And So, you know, Linda's going to Al-Anon, and I'm going along. I was sober about a month. I went on a business trip to the West Coast, drank on the business trip, came back. I was sober for about 3 months, and we got married. And I think I, in the back of my mind, had a plan to drink on our honeymoon all the time. I just didn't talk about it consciously. And we honeymooned in Mexico, and you know where the divers dive off those cliffs? I dove off those cliffs on my last drunk. I was in the audience watching a world's high diving contest. I thought, God, that's not so tough. Dove off the public landing, climbed up the cliff, got up to about 85 or 90 feet, split my swimsuit, cut my leg. You know, Linda's going absolutely nuts. I'm trying to figure out whether to dive or jump. Finally figured out, screw it, and I dove. God watches after fools and drunks because I made it. Would have died if I jumped. You have to get out about 30 feet to hit the channel. About 10 years later, Linda gave me a card. We're in Mexico, and she gave me a card saying, "There but for the grace of God," and it showed the chasm at La Quebrada. And she said, God, that's the dumbest thing I've ever done. And she said, "Bob, it's not even in the top 10. So. So I don't know how two people can share a life and see it so differently. You know, it's a... So I came back. I had about 3 months sobriety, and when I had that slip, and I came back, and I turned myself in and got extraordinarily active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I made a lot of, you know, I just was everywhere. I just loved AA. I got active in everything. I'm going to meetings. I'm going to detoxes. I'm going active in prisons. I'm doing a lot. My sponsor was a great 12-stepper. I'm doing a lot of 12-stepping. And I'm making a lot of progress. And all of a sudden, when I'm about, I don't know, the first year was just like a honeymoon. I just coasted. You know, I did the steps. I went through my steps. But I mostly it was extraordinarily easy period of time for me when the circumstances of my life were not easy. I had a lot of debt, and I had a lot of things that I had to take care of, and I had work issues and different issues, but they were like invisible to me. During my second year, I started to get a pretty good list of my defects of character. During my third year, they started to bother me, and during my fourth and fifth year, they started to eat my lunch. And it seemed like, for me, I started out wonderfully and then flattened out and then started to go downhill. And this is the story of my life, you know. I mean, you know, Sterling talked about it, Bob talked about it, Tim talked about it. You know, great starters, poor finishers. That's the story of my life. You know, I'm a guy, I interview well, I just don't work well. And it's a flaw, but I, you know. So I start to have, you know, when I came in AA, maybe the biggest thing that happened to me is I tore down the wall I had built up between you and me. What alcoholism took away from me was a little bit extra that it took to be a success. And when that started to happen to me, I started to build a wall up so that you couldn't see what was going on inside my life. The thinking that went on behind my wall said, "You like me, but you only like what I let you see about me. If you saw everything about me, you'd hate me because I hate me. And who knows more what a lousy, crummy, insufficient person I am than me. I'm walking around comparing my inside with your outsides." But at some point in time, behind that wall, you get sick enough, tired enough, hurt enough, and afraid enough that you start to tear that wall down and you say, "Hey, come and get me. I don't care who you are, where you come from, but just come and get me and help me not be who I am anymore. I can't stand me 5 more minutes. Now, I started to tear that wall down when I called AA. I took more of it down in the step work, and when I finished my fifth step, I had the wall entirely down, and I made a discovery. And the discovery was, I'm not unique. My personality may be unique, but not my illness, not my behavior, and not my feelings. And when I found out I wasn't unique, I started to have a sense of hope that maybe what worked for you could work for me. If there's anything that almost all of us walk in with the Alcoholics Anonymous, it's an overdeveloped sense of uniqueness. If you don't get rid of some of that, it will kill you because you will look for the differences and not the similarities. You have to somehow start to identify to be able to make a strong enough connection, I think, to start to feel in your heart what's here is going to work. And I started, you know, I made that connection. I tore my wall down. I felt like, you know, I'm home, baby. This is what's working for me. I've been looking for an answer all my life to why I couldn't get it together. Why do I always start well? Why can't I finish it? Now I found my answer. I'm an alcoholic. And I started working the steps, and I started making progress. My second year, I got a list of defects of character. My third, fourth, and fifth year, they're starting to eat my lunch. I feel like I'm going backwards. I'm now exhibiting in Alcoholics Anonymous the same pattern I've exhibited in my life all the way through. Now, the problems I had in sobriety were very ordinary problems. I couldn't get up in the morning. I later found out that it had something to do with when you went to bed, but at the time, I did not know that. I spent about $300 or $400 more a month than I made. If you do that over an extended period of time, you end up in debt. I just want to report that to you in case you don't know where that's going. I had some parenting. We started to have kids, and I started to have parents. I had great parents, but even great parents make mistakes, and I wasn't going to make the mistakes my parents did, and I didn't. I made all the mistakes they made and a bunch they never thought of. I was loud, impatient, angry, immature, and sometimes violent. I'm not proud of that, but that was an accurate description of how I was. I used to say, well, I didn't have any marital problems. Linda said, yes, you did. You just didn't know it. And I had a gambling issue. It was more of a hobby. 4 or 5 hours a day, 4 or 5 days a week. It wasn't a big deal. It was, but I was making $5 to $10 grand a year playing backgammon. It was kind of like a second job. Now, I had all those problems when I came in AA. None of those were on my first inventory list. That's how uninsightful my first inventory was. My first inventory was a list of the worst things I had done in my life. And, you know, that was what I had at the time going through the book. That's what I got. I wouldn't go back and redo that. That just wasn't a very insightful process. So one by one, I used to take these issues on. One by one, I'd start to do it, and I'd make some progress. But by and large, I wasn't making much progress in these 4 or 5 areas of my life. And when I got to be 4 or 5 years sober, these things were really eating my lunch. I was starting to feel bad. And what happened to me is I built my wall back up sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. Thanks a lot for helping my drinking problem, but stay out of my sex life. Stay out of my marriage. Stay out of my parenting. Stay out of my finances. Stay out of my gambling. Brick by brick, sober, going to 4 or 5 meetings a week, I built my wall back up where I don't want you to see what's going on. I'm starting to have issues. Everybody's patting me on the head, talking about the young guy who's doing so well, and I don't want people to see the problems that I've got. I'm telling my sponsor 65% of what's going on. And I know in Montana you do 100. I think that's terrific. I really do. But I was only doing about 65. But you know what? I was only telling myself about 65%. I couldn't face up to the reality of my life. I lived in a gaga land. I mean, I just couldn't see it the way it was. We talk about not being able to face life on life's terms. I was unable to face my life on life's terms. So I just, you know, through denial or suppression or whatever the hell you want to call it, I just wasn't, you know, able to face a lot of what was going on in my life. But life is relentless. As my spiritual advisor said, life is a school, love is a subject. The universe will keep presenting you with the lessons you have to learn. And relentlessly, it kept pushing in front of my nose the lessons I had. I'd be at the club talking to a new guy, 11 o'clock at night, I get him a cup of coffee, he comes in with a bushel basket full of manure that the new guy comes in with, and I say, hey, as bad as it is and as hopeless as it seems, you're in the right place. If you stay here, get a sponsor, get in the book, and try to do the steps, even if you don't do it, you do it okay. You don't even have to do it perfectly. You're going to be okay. You see that guy over there? 2 years ago, his life was a mess. Now he's knocking it out of the park. You're going to be okay. Then I get in the car at 11 o'clock at night, and I drive home, and I say, Bob, when are you going to be okay? You're 5 years old. When are you going to learn how to work? When are you going to get on a budget? When are you going to stop spending money you don't have to buy things you don't need to impress people you don't like? You know. When are you going to be a better husband? When are you going to be a better father? When are you going to stop gambling? I didn't have an answer because I'm really trying to do these things and I can't get it done. And in my sixth and seventh year, I hit a wall. I just ran out of, I just hit a wall. There have been a couple of talks. Bob talked about maybe guys leaving Alcoholics Anonymous. I was thinking about suicide. I wasn't thinking about drinking. I wasn't thinking about leaving AA. I just didn't want one more term where I was going to be a failure. I don't know why I had trouble working. That was a major issue in my life. I just wouldn't perform. I don't know what the hell it was. I was working 3-4 hours a day. I'm going gambling 4 or 5, 6 hours a day. That's how I'm supporting myself. I got a piece of me that likes people assuming that if I ever really put it on the line, I'd be dynamite, but I don't like putting it on the line. I don't want to put it all on the line and have people see that I'm a C plus to a B. I want to have them assume that if I really tried, you know, this guy's doing pretty good not even trying. If he ever really tried, if he ever really put it on the line, he'd be dynamite. That's what they assumed in school. I was always the guy with potential. That's what they assumed when I got into work life, and that wasn't the way it was. And I was, what I did not know is I was scared to death of what was going on. And I finally got to the end of that string. And you're at the point where you're either, I'm seriously thinking about committing suicide or talking to my sponsor. And you just, you absolutely are not sure which of those two is the right. Why? I mean, what is that? I got a guy who has never been inappropriate with me. He loves me. I'm at meetings with him, you know, constantly. I'm at his house once or twice a week. And I'm afraid to go over and have the, he knows 65% at least. Now that I'm older, I know that he knows about 85% of what's going on. You know, he wasn't the one that expected me to be perfect. I was the one that expected me to be perfect. When I'm sponsoring 23 and 4 and 5 and 6-year-old guys, I don't expect that their lives are going to be entirely together. I'm comparing myself to the 45-year-olds in the group who've got careers and houses and cars, and I'm 23 years old and I'm comparing myself to them. Of course, I don't feel very good about myself. So at the end of this trip, you know, and I got a problem. The problem is, by this time I really know what the answer is. The answer is to find a stronger, better relationship with God and find out what the hell that had to do with Wednesday. The problem is, when I go to ask God for that relationship, what do you think God's going to do? You have to be a rocket scientist to figure out what God's going to ask me to do. Go to work. Stay at work. Work at work. New approach. Get on a budget. That's a tough word. I think that's an Al-Anon word. I really think that is a. And by the way, last night when you had that list, you should add to the list is when you're dying, someone else's life flashes before your eyes. You could be an Al-Anon. Stop gambling. Be kinder to your kids. Get a life. Now, the problem with that is, what the hell you think I've been trying to do for the last 4 years? You know, when I've had that list. It's on my list. I've been busting my britches trying to get that. And I care about how I live my life, and I've not been able to clean these things up. See, I'm a great starter. I don't finish. And out of desperation, you know, and I said, what the hell is the use of developing a relationship with God if you can't fulfill the conditions of the relationship? I was stuck there. I was stuck there for almost 2 years. And out of desperation, I just went back to the steps. I'd never really left them, but I went back to the steps at 7 years sober. Your father was dying. It was about the time the International was in Denver. I didn't get to go to it because you went home to see your father. And I went back to the steps. I took a look at what step one meant to me when I was 8 years sober, 7 or 8 years sober. Well, that was easy. Right? My life was unmanageable, and I was powerless. The second step was the one that threw me for a loop. I had lost my belief in the second step. If you would have asked me to put my hand on a lie detector and said, do you believe God's going to restore your sanity? The answer is yes. Question, do you believe God's going to restore Bob Bazan's sanity? Answer is no. I'm 7 years sober. I'm on the down escalator going up. My life's going backwards. It's getting worse, not better. I'm busting my britches. I got all the patches. I'm sponsoring guys. I'm giving talks. I'm doing the steps. I got all the Boy Scout patches. I'm doing the right things in my life. I'm going backwards. I got pigeons making more progress in life than I'm making. You know, so, I mean, there's some built-in failure mechanism going on here. I don't know what the hell's going on, but it's not working. So when you're in trouble, you get more active or less active. I got more active. I started to see people with smiles on their faces, with bigger problems, walking through walls that I was trying to avoid. And all of a sudden, I regained the belief that God would restore Bob Bazan's sanity. I took a third step with my sponsor on my knees in his office. We didn't do that in those days. It was a little awkward, but I figured this time, I heard people who were talking in AA that were doing that. And I did a fourth step, and my first couple of fifth steps I did with clergy, I did this one with my sponsor. I said, when you're done, be careful. Whatever you request of me, I'm going to do. He wanted me to go to a psychologist. I had a lot of issues around work success and failure. My father was a pretty successful guy. I thought I'd never be as good as my old man. I didn't know what was going on, but I knew I didn't know how to work. So I went to a psychologist. And I'm about halfway through those meetings. He wanted to get Linda involved. I thought, oh, crap. Well, they see it so differently. Some would say more honestly. I think they just confused the issues. And he wanted to get my children involved, and I was embarrassed about how I was with my children. I didn't want them involved, but we brought them. And I remember I was sitting in John's office, and he looked at me, and he said, with Daniel and Billy, no, Peter and Billy and you. And he said, why? I was explaining to him that my company was going down the tubes. You know, I don't know why I'm busting my ass to a couple hours a day, and it's just not working. And it's, And he looks at me and he says, why are you so afraid of failing? And I wanted to hit him. That's not my first reaction with most people, but I said, look, you're a goddamn doctor. I said, you fail, you file bankruptcy, you just take your little sign, walk down the hall, pound it on another door, within 6 months you're making $100,000. I said, I'm in the investment business. I'm living in a town I was born and raised in. I said, I'm about to lose everything I had. I said, nod your head up and down if you understand that. I said, I'm about to lose everything I had. And he looks at Linda, and he says, Linda, if Bob lost everything he had, would he lose you? And she says, no. And he asked the same question to the kids, and the kids said, nope. If you can't lose, you can't play. So I'm a guy who always looks like a winner. My mother always said, Bob, you're not very bright. Dress well. And I have... developed the gift of being deeply shallow. I've gotten that to an art form that few people have. And, we laugh about it, but if you went through the room like this, few of us are operating, where we need to be operating. And what I discovered in that room, in that moment, almost 8 years sober, going to 4 or 5 meetings a week, I have maybe the best sponsor that was certainly available in the group I attended. And I'm a student of the book. And I discovered fear. I'd done 3 inventories. I'm afraid of being a husband. I'm afraid of being a father. I'm afraid of failure. I'm afraid of success. And I don't know any of this. I am scared crapless. I am swimming in it and don't know that I'm swimming in it. About a month and a half after that session, I was home reading some non-conference approved literature. And it had been one of the worst days I had in AA. I went to work late, left early, got in a backgammon game, won $600, got, missed dinner, missed the AA meeting, got in a fight with my wife and slapped one of the kids. I was going to have it videotaped and sent to the General Service Office to show what 8 years could do for you, but I didn't have a camera. And I'm sitting in my chair, and I said, gee, it happened again. And my head said, weren't you there? And I said, yeah, but it's so habitual, it's almost like I'm in a blackout. I don't have to think about what I'm doing. It's like it. And then something else came in and said, bull roar. Your life is the way it is because you designed it that way. You sound like a guy who wants to stop gambling. You want to gamble whenever the hell you want to gamble for as much money as you want to gamble and not have problems because of gambling. You sound like a guy who wants to spend time with his wife, to spend time with his children. You want their love and affection without giving time to your wife and children. You want money without work. bad design. Hard conversation. When I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, I surrendered. I took step one with my alcoholism. I stood naked in front of my alcoholism, and the truth of that look altered me. I drank twice briefly afterwards, but it was not for free, and it never worked. That truth altered me. That night, I was stripped, and I stood in front of my life. And I realized that I had tried pretty gall-dang hard, not perfectly, but pretty damn hard, to clean my act up, and I had failed. New thought, maybe it's okay. Maybe you're where you're supposed to be. And I was given the privilege to get down on my knees and take the sixth and the seventh step of Alcoholics Anonymous. The sixth step said, we're entirely ready to have God remove our defects of character. The seventh step said, we humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. I'd spent 8 years trying to get rid of them. I don't have the power to get rid of them. I'm the pipe, not the well. It happens through me, not by me. That night I got down on my knees and became entirely ready, and four of the major issues in my life disappeared that night, such as the power of the steps and such as the power of God. I stopped gambling that night. I'm the type of guy that when I want to go on a diet, first thing I do is I buy a bag of cookies and some ice cream. It's already been a bad day. I'm just going to finish it off. I'm probably never again going to have ice cream, so I, just going to be my last hurrah. So if any of you understand that, you will understand why some of my resolutions have not been as successful as I would have liked. But I knew that God's will for me was to make a change, and I knew that if I didn't have some structure to it, it wouldn't work. I went to my sponsor, and I made an appointment with my sponsor about when I'd go to work and when I'd leave work. I started dating my wife. For 25 or 30 years, I dated Linda on every Friday night. It was a real live, dangerous date. No one else went out on that date. We got dressed up and we went out and had dinner. I had to learn how to be romantic with Linda. We found ourselves talking about kids and bills, not how we fell in love, and it was like business and all of, so we had to start stacking up again, go to Chicago, get some juice, back in the game and learn how to, be romantic with each other. That was maybe the best thing we ever did. I spent thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours trying to learn how to be a better parent. I think being a parent's like having a bowling alley installed in your head. It is one of the most demanding, I think it takes 125% of whatever you got. I mean, it's a big deal. And that night I quit gambling. My life took off like it was on a rocket ship. For the next 10 years, everything I touched turned to gold. The guy who couldn't work with the partner built a company with 350 employees, and I was in the real estate investment business. Lucky at, there's a little luck involved. There's a lot of luck involved in business, and I was positioned kind of at the right time, and we grew really big. 1986, they passed the Tax Act. But what I want to say is the power of the step is extraordinary. Bob used the word ritual. I would prefer the word practice. What we have in AA is what people in Eastern traditions call a practice. We have a group of spiritual principles in nature that, if practiced, will alter our lives and will clear away a path for us that maybe we can't even exactly identify. But there's a way of knowing that we have as time goes on where you just, I don't know how we say it, do the right next thing, live in the now, be present, just, look for God's will for us. There's lots of different ways in our tradition that we say that. But one of the most powerful things about Alcoholics Anonymous is we have a profoundly powerful spiritual program coupled with the most practical access that you can get to profound spiritual principles anywhere. We have a tradition where we share those principles through the experience of our lives, not through ideology. When we go on a 12-step call, we don't talk about the ideology of the steps or the ideas of the steps or the principle. We talk about our drinking. We talk about the change. We bring it alive, and in the bringing of our lives into that conversation, magic happens. Almost all of us that have been in a 12-step call, or almost all of us in the parking lot after the meeting, had said something we didn't know. That was just the right thing to say at just the right moment, and you watch it come out of your mouth. You go, wow. And that happened through you, not by you, not by your head, not by your knowledge. You know, I love what someone said, Aristotle said it, and said, you can't learn anything you don't already know. And don't you get the feeling when you're at an AA meeting or at an AA talk and Daryl's giving the talk, there's part of you that's going, yeah. I mean, but it's like you already knew what he said, but sort of didn't know it. And it's like he opened a door on it when he said it. And in the speaking of it, he made it accessible to you, made it available to you, and afterwards, it's yours. It was always there. And it seems like that's what my walk in Alcoholics Anonymous has been like. It's been like learning what part of me always knew. I thought my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous was going to take me to be someone else. And what it has done is return me to who I have always been. It's a journey home. It's not a journey someplace else. That's why there's nothing in our way. That's why there's nothing missing. It is a journey to who you have always been. You are not unwhole. You are whole, intact, fully equipped to be prosperous and whole in your own life. There is nothing in the, there are obstacles in the way, psychological, mental, and spiritual obstacles, then physical obstacles that we have to clear away through the practice of doing the steps. So when I cleared that away, and I think the closure on that practice is steps 8 and 9. I think that if there's a short shrift in some places in the practice, in our area, I think we're a little too intellectual. I think that's a little bit of the result of treatment. I think we do some things better than some area. I think we overdo step 4 and we overdo step 5. I think almost everybody somewhat underappreciates 6 and 7. But 8 and 9 is the get out of jail free card. When I'd finished 8 and 9 after that process of doing those steps, my life took off like a rocket ship. And I think what happens, it's like if I borrow $2,000 from John, I'll pay you back. My tax return's coming through. I just need a couple of grand. And John gives me the couple of grand. And I, you know, either don't have a tax return, lied to him, or I get the tax return and spend it. And so I don't want to see John, so I start attending the meetings a little bit less often. And he's kind of a jerk, and he's got a lot of money. And so I need to kill John. I mean, you know, I can't leave John alive in this process, you know, because that's going to bother me. So I have to neutralize John. And so I'm in a different group if I'm still going to AA. And you know, but every time John comes around in the carousel of my mind, my lights dim. You can just see my battery drain. You can just see the lights turn orange. And we don't have one of those. We got 10, 15, 20. You hear people today, happiness is knowing who to blame. You know, more people are blaming parents. Most of us would have better lives if we clean up our act with our parents and brothers and sisters. And when we, those are like dark holes. Those are like black holes. Those suck energy. When you complete those, that energy is returned to you to live your life. And I really believe, well, you know, we are the one that we say alcoholics are pretty intelligent people. This is the only room you will hear that in. You will not hear that at an Al-Anon conference. And you will not hear it out in the world much. But what's holding us back? That's holding us back. Bob talked about that mask. You know, I mean, our feelings and thoughts are printed on our eyeball. That's our only reality. You want freedom from that? You got to get it out here. When it's printed on your eyeball, there is no other reality. But through spiritual practice, through the taking of the steps, those ideas that are here start to get here. Then they start to get here. And you start to get some freedom and detachment. Those noises, that story in your head does not go away. So last night, I'm comparing myself to Daryl. Do I go as many meetings as he do? Do I sponsor as many guys? Why am I not doing jail work? What am I doing comparing myself? That's my automatic. I don't have to think about that. I just do that. I just walk around comparing myself. If I'm not careful, that's my ego comparing myself. I don't want the process. I don't want to do the work. I just want the badges. That's what I do. That's what my mind does. That's what my ego does. So my life took off on a rocket ship. I made a lot of money. Bought the new house, had fancy cars, had the stuff. They passed the Tax Act in 1980. There are issues with failure. There are issues with success. I'm the guy in the new Mercedes and the expensive suit and the tie walking in the meeting thinking, God has blessed me because I'm a wonderful member of Alcoholics Anonymous. How would you like to have been in my group? You know, I mean, arrogance is like invisible. You know, I don't even see it. You know, I was so concerned about the issues of failure, I never even saw the issues of my success. 1986, they passed the Tax Act. I started to lose everything I had. I went to my spiritual advisor and said, I wanted him to help me. What do you want? I want to be less materialistic and more spiritual. I want to be more like Bob White. Within about 2 months, I started to lose everything I had. That's right. I went back to him and said, we have to talk. I said, I want to be less materialistic, but I want to keep the stuff. In 4 years, I lost $8 million and gained 40 pounds. I was going to write a book, but I could not find a publisher. I lost the big house. I lost the Mercedes. Losing the money was not like, you know, changing clothes. It was like tearing the skin off my body. I was in a clinical depression. I was in the fetal position under my desk. For 2 years, I was mostly dysfunctional. This is not pretty. My kid's in treatment. Our kid. He's our kid, right? Both of ours. And we go to the meeting on Friday. Peter came home from college and cracked up the car, totaled it, got arrested for drunken driving, ended up in detox. It was kind of his Christmas present to Linda and I. And we... So he's at a halfway house, and we're going to the meetings on Fridays. I'm sitting down in the front row. I start crying. I start crying during your Al-Anon talk, but I start crying the moment Peter was there. The meeting starts. Can't you see the new guys? You know, saying, see that guy over there? He's got 26 years. How'd you like to have what he has? You know, I think he's got the clap. I don't know what the hell's going on. I certainly wasn't free. So one of the big lessons for me is I had to find out who I was with money and who I was without money. I had to find out who I was independent of that process. Am I still materialistic? Yeah. You know, that's part of my personality. Am I willing to change that? Yes, I think I'm willing to change it. Has it changed? No, not entirely. You know, it seems like you don't lose your tendencies. I think people who have a tendency to anger will have a tendency to that through their lives. It'll be something they have to attend to. It can become almost not present. But if that's your design and that's where you leak, I think that's where you will leak. I have an issue with anger. I have not lost it. But it does not cause the damage to the people I care about in my life with the frequency. The other night I took off on Linda. Every once in a while I do it just to prove I can still be an asshole. And it's like riding a bicycle. It comes back, you know, instantaneous. But I don't do it very often, and it isn't, but I can still occasionally do it. And that's not a lie. It is not present in my life like that. And when I got an insight when I was talking about it. I say it's anger. I am enormously anxious. And I think I'm starting to see that it's as much anxiousness and angst as it is anger. I think my response to it, you know, so it's fear. It is, you know, she's saying something I don't want to hear. I'm in front of something I don't want to hear. You know, so I'm going through that. So life, if you're a good guy, I used to think recovery was the absence of problems. Because I thought if you had a good program, you didn't have problems. I thought if you're a good Christian, you didn't have problems. You didn't sin. That's not what it is. You're not, if you're going to be in Alcoholics Anonymous and you got a great program, you're just going to have your turn in the barrel. You just are. You're going to leak. I'm not promoting poor behavior, but they just don't make people who don't have issues. I'm sober 38 years. This December. During some of that process, you're going to have marital problems. You're going to have health issues. You're going to have financial issues. You're going to have kid issues if you have children. You are not immune from life. But what do? We think it means something. We think it means, and it might. If you're having a serious marital problem, it might mean, we've gotten marriage counseling 2 or 3 different times in our marriage career. I've gone to get outside help a number of times. You know, does that mean AA doesn't work? Does that mean I got a crappy program? I don't think so. I drag everything I have back into my program. My program is the baseline because it's got so much common sense. It's got a BS detector that I think is second to none in Alcoholics Anonymous. So and I have people who I check it with. You know, I got 5 more minutes and I want to do my thing on change. So what is the process of recovery? It's a process of growth. It's a process of a spiritual walk. It's a process of change. Most of us, I think, if I said, raise your hand, which I'm not asking you to do, if you'd like to get rid of the things in your life that don't work and hurt other people, almost all of us would say, sign me up. But I want to tell you something. There's more of you that is afraid of change than you would ever believe. During my early sobriety, I worked pretty hard, and I tried and failed, and I still grew. But there comes a time in your recovery where you have to change or you stop growing. In early recovery, you can still have a fair amount of issues and not deal with them effectively, and you can still grow and you can still change because there's room for that. But what happens is you start to get in your middle and your more mature recovery, you start to make choices. You start to find out where your treasure is, and you start to run into, on the spiritual journey, you run into what's in your way. And if you don't deal with it, it will start to weaken you. And you get to the point where you got to make a choice, you got to change. You know, one of the things for me was my abuse with my children. I'd slap my kids, or I'd spank my kids, or I'd pull their hair once in a while. That was a pattern that was in my family. I'm 2 or 3 generations old. I'm responsible for it. I'm not blaming anybody. I love my father. He was my hero, and I just changed roles. That was just, you know, but I'm responsible. But I blame it on Peter. If you were Peter's father, and all of a sudden I realized, oh, give me a break. If your brother was Peter's father, would he hit him? If you were my kid's father, would you hit him? No. Only 2 out of 10, or 1 out of 10 would hit him. Where's the problem? Okay. But that's a hard conversation to have with yourself if you're not ready to have that conversation. So the closer you get, you know, so you get to a choice where you have to change or you have to stop growing. And at that point in time, if you decide not to change, you build an addition onto your house to accommodate the problem. Chasers hang out with the chasers, gamblers hang out with the gamblers, and you make a deal. I won't call you on your crap, you don't call me on mine. We'll talk about the steps, we'll go to meetings, we'll talk about the traditions. You stay out of my face, I'll stay out of yours, okay? Bad deal. And we train people about what they can talk about, what they can't talk about. Your sponsor knows what conversations you're open for and what you're not open for. The people in your group know what they know whether they can talk to you about what's going on at home or not talk to you about what's going on at home. You're not kidding anybody. You train your wife with a look. We're not having that conversation. You want to have that conversation? It's going to be a tough conversation. It's going to be an expensive conversation. You train your kids. You train your coworkers. You train your boss. You start training people about what they can talk to you about and what they can't talk to you about. So when we think we're so open to change, not so open. I got a new way that I work with guys. Let's pretend I'm sponsoring a guy 35, 40 years old with kids, married. And he's having trouble with the 4-step. You know, all the columns and stuff. I say, that's complicated. I said, just get your wife and kids and your mom and dad and your brothers and sisters and your boss and a couple of guys in the group and your neighbors and bring them over to the house. And serve coffee, and here's what I want you to say. Just say, we have a step in Alcoholics Anonymous where we try to get in touch with our defects of character, and I'm having trouble identifying mine. And I was wondering if you'd help. And then leave. You'd have a pretty good start. But you know why most of us wouldn't call that meeting? Okay? We don't want to change. But it's worse than that. We don't want to know. We are afraid of change. We have gotten to the point where we identify so much with our thinking that we think it's who we are. It isn't who we are. It is simply thoughts and behaviors. You can change your thoughts and behaviors, and it doesn't change who you are. It's not muscle and bone. But we identify with it so strongly, it's almost as if we are afraid that that's what we are. I'm a thief. I'm a abuser. I'm a gambler. No, I gamble. I gamble inappropriately. It causes me issues. That's a behavior. I can change that behavior. I can change my party from Republican to Democrat. It doesn't change who I am. That's not who I be. It's what I do. The process of change in the program is altering being, not doing. Once you change who you be, doing comes automatically out of that. The steps are spiritual. If they were mechanical, all you'd have to do every time you had a problem is say the third step prayer and click your heels, you'd be back in Kansas. But a lot of times we go there and we can't do that because no one's home. And sometimes we have to do things mechanically, and it's okay to do them mechanically. But you hear a lot of people talking about the steps. We've got a dozen tapes back there about how to go through the steps. But the steps are not mechanical. There's a lot of people who have the first 164 pages of the book memorized, and I would not want to go on a fishing trip with them, and I'm not impressed with the way they live their lives. They got the menu memorized, but they're starving to death, some people. Memorizing the menu is not nutrition. Practicing the principles and living it is the nurturing and the nutrition that we need in our lives. And it's not easy, and it is messy, and it's not perfect, and it happens over time. It doesn't just happen with information. It is not an intellectual process. It is a practice. And people who have practices, will, if they're honest with you, will tell you all of us have trouble with our practice. But we're travelers. What I do is I'm a practicer. I'm a practitioner. That's what I do. And I do it better today than I've done it before. And I'm hoping that I'm going to become a master practitioner. I'm a better practitioner today than I used to be, and I want to be on a path of growth. Is it perfect? No. But does it work? You bet. And what do you find in it? Do you get happiness? Maybe. Happiness is more circumstantially dependent. But I'll tell you something. You get peace and joy. You get out of jail. Peace and joy are not dependent on circumstances. You are going to have times in your life where you're going to have pain, but you need not have suffering. Suffering is due to the denial and the unacceptance of the circumstances. Pain is just the circumstances. But you know people who are dying that have peace and joy. You know people who have less money than you have that have peace and joy. So I think the gift that we've been given in Alcoholics Anonymous is that the bad news is we have a disease that if we don't deal with it, it's going to kill us and destroy the lives of five or six people around us. The good news is in order to get well, we have to learn how to live. It's almost as if we're being forced to a place that will give us a deeper, better, richer, more whole life than we ever would have had if we'd never had the problem of alcoholism. And for most of us that have been around for a while, we know that's a gift. Thank you for one of the nicest weekends I've ever had.